The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rant hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rant, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rant, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Senator Mike Patton stops by. He actually has a bill that would make fentanyl possession a felony again, but will it go anywhere? He'll explain. Antioch University in Seattle apparently is going after a student for pushing back against wokeness on campus. Plus, why are so many Washingtonians buying guns? We'll explain this hour of the Jason Rant Show. So, let's get into it.
The monologue.
We learned that as a condition of employment, King County and the city of Seattle no longer requires proof of vaccination against COVID. This was a decision that should have been made, could have been made about a year and a half ago. But they chose to ignore the science while telling us that they were actually listening to it. In fact, I'm going to read to you just a portion of the statement coming from Dow Constantine, who is just embarrassingly, transparently, hideously awful at his job. But he says, since the earliest days of the COVID-19 pandemic, King County's policy has been to follow the science, listen to the experts, and protect life and health. Really? You meant, let's correct that. Follow the science that is politically advantageous. Listen to the experts that agree with us. Protect life and health by pretending the vaccine stops the spread of COVID. They lied so often. I wonder if they can tell the difference now between what is, in fact, based in science and what was based on their political agenda. He says, establishing a vaccine mandate for employees and contractors was critical to keeping employees and the public safe and keeping services flowing. Today, our experts advise that immunity has reached a level that allows these requirements to be relaxed. What's the level? Do you know what the level is? I don't know what the level is.
I don't know what the level is.
Is this herd immunity? What is that number now? Oh, curious. With high vaccination rates, what does that have to do with anything? Vaccine does not stop the spread of COVID. But he says, with high vaccination rates and effective updated boosters available, we're in a different place in the pandemic. He's still spreading the lie that the vaccine stops the spread of COVID. Why not just simply come out and say, again, it's so easy to message this. There's two things you can say. Now, had they agreed to be honest a while ago, they could have said, look, we did what we thought was in the best interest for our citizens. We just wanted to protect you. Our hearts were in the right place. However, we were wrong at the end of this. We came from a good place. We had good intentions. And I know good intentions don't always matter, but I assure you, the reason why we did what we did, the policies we implemented, we did this for the preservation of life. We were wrong in many of these cases, and we're sorry. Please know that we're doing our best, but this was a brand new virus. We had no treatment, nothing at the start of this. And we reacted the way we did because we wanted to protect you. And we went too far. Could have done that. They choose not to. Now they could finally come out and say, look, we believe that the data suggests that it gives you more protection when you're vaccinated, but we know now, we've known for a while, that it doesn't stop the spread of COVID. Our policy was based on a vaccine that stopped the spread, and we were told by Pfizer and the pharmaceutical company that suddenly we're now trusting would never ever lie to us for a profit. We were told that it stopped the spread of COVID. Clearly, that's not the case. That's on us. We trusted the wrong people. But again, we did it in your best interest. We didn't mean to abuse our power. I'm sorry. But here's a reason why you should still get the booster, whatever it is. They won't do it. They absolutely refuse to do it. Which means, I hope you're in my camp of absolutely refusing to forgive them.
The interview.
You know, the one thing we can say about Democrats in Washington State who try to come after guns, they do end up selling a whole lot of guns. Joining me on the line from the Second Amendment Foundation, Dave Workman. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me back. You're right. Every time they push a piece of gun control legislation, people flock to gun stores in this state. It's as predictable as rain in February. So,
well, you actually looked at the concealed carry numbers. What did you find out?
Yeah. Well, I get a monthly report from the Department of Licensing, and the reason I do that is because I'm trying to keep track of the trends, and more people going out to buy firearms, more people getting licensed to carry firearms. At the same time, we've gone through 2 years of what I think is really horrible politics, where they have defunded police. The police manpower has been reduced, especially in Seattle. They've lost something like, correct me if I'm wrong, but 300 or 400 officers.
Mm-hmm.
And
500.
It's 500. Well, see, there you go. This is the kind of news that compels people to decide, hey, it's time for me to take more responsibility for my own safety. So, A, I'm going to go buy a gun. I'm going to go get some training. I'm going to apply for a concealed carry permit or a license, actually, in this state, and so that they can defend themselves outside of their homes, which is where most of the crime happens anyway.
Yeah, and, you know, count me as one of them. I'm heading over tomorrow to West Coast Armory North, a new sponsor. I'm a big Second Amendment supporter, but I haven't really done a lot in firing lately, mostly because, you know, I'm busy. But now all of a sudden, you know what? My interest has been peaked back up to the point where I'm going to go out. Do you get a sense as to whether or not these are pre-existing gun owners just expanding their collection, or are these just brand new gun owners?
A lot of them are brand new gun owners. And I tell you, Jason, this is an interesting thing. First, I'm going to correct you on something. You're not a Second Amendment supporter. You are a Second Amendment practitioner.
There you go.
I think there's a whole different deal at work there. But yeah, when I talk to people who own gun shops, as I occasionally do, I get the sense that anywhere from 25% to 50% of their customers are brand new wannabe gun owners. And that's not surprising considering the news we've seen lately. The murder rate in Seattle is going up. It went up in 2022. There's no indication that it's slowing down. We've already had 7 homicides.
Yep.
Just already this year. And the thing that I've noticed more than anything else is that a lot of this has happened since Washington State started getting more restrictive with its gun control laws. In my estimation, and I wrote about this last week twice in the Gun Mag, Thursday and Friday, in my estimation, the gun control campaign in this state has been an abject failure. It has not delivered on any of its promises to reduce crime. In fact, it's gone just the other way. And I've heard you talk about this on the air several times. So, you know, we're both on the same page on this.
The only thing I always wonder about and worry about when there is a rush to purchase a gun, and I do think that when you start talking about bans, someone who's maybe on the fence or thinking about it feels a little bit more compelled to rush a decision, is that they may not be as safe or responsible. So how much are we seeing about the increase in just, you know, training and making sure that people who are purchasing a weapon are doing so responsibly?
Well, I think if you check at places, you know, like you're going to a gun shop today, or check the weights, or you're West Coast. There are 2 or 3 different gun shops around here. I'm pretty sure they all offer at least introductory gun safety classes. And I'll bet you that there's a waiting list at those places just for people to get in who are new gun owners. They want to be safe with them. And, you know, firearms ownership is a big responsibility. And, you know, and we can thank all the gods and all the heavens that the majority of people who are buying guns for the first time really are interested in practicing firearm safety. And good for them.
What kind of firearms are they purchasing? Have you been able to tell?
Yeah,
I know, not necessarily from the reporting, but from other data.
Well, in my snooping around, I think the majority of people are buying handguns because they, you know, they want to carry them, so they're going to get licenses to carry. There are a fair number of people who have been trying to purchase semi-automatic modern sporting rifles, and that's not a surprise because there's legislation down in Olympia right now to ban those things. I remember last year, prior to the ban on so-called large capacity magazines going into effect, there was a rush on those too. People were buying them off the internet. They were buying them at gun shows, buying them from firearms retailers. So that sort of thing is proof positive that people may talk about gun control, but when push comes to shove, when they think their rights might be restricted, they go to the gun shop with a checkbook.
Yeah, there you go. Second Amendment Foundation is doing some amazing work in this field. SAF.org. SAF.org. Dave Workman, thank you so much, as always.
You betcha. Take care.
You as well. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.
The Monologue.
So, speaking of protection, the Liquor and Cannabis Board is offering free on-site security assessments to pot shops all across Washington State because they keep getting hit by thieves. We've done many, many, many stories over the course of the last year. Last year, we saw a huge surge in pot shops getting targeted. Jeffrey Slotnick is the president of Cetricon. This is the private security company that has been contracted by the Liquor and Cannabis Board. And he told King 5, hey, there's some simple solutions that could prevent some crimes, like something called bollards. Those are those steel yellow fixtures that you have blocking car traffic, basically.
One of our recommendations is that in front of these retail shops, they should emplace bollards. Why should they emplace bollards? Well, it would have prevented the three robberies that occurred just a few months ago where people were stealing a vehicle and using it to drive into the front of a building. Really is about making places safer for their employees, protecting life and protecting property.
Yeah, those bollards will stop the guys from entering with guns and then just stealing a bunch of the pot and cash and then jumping into a parked car that's also stolen right in front of the bollards. But I'm sure that'll work. Tirza owns Goobies Doobies in Maple Valley. She recently had a robbery.
A couple of guys came in and held up the store with the guns and stole some product and ran off.
And obviously, as she tells King 5, yeah, we would love to get suggestions to improve our security.
The liquor board did give us some tips and some advice when they came in after the robbery. But I think it would be great to have an actual security firm come in and say, hey, these are things that you could do to improve your security.
There's nothing you can do to improve your security that will work better than rescinding the law that made this more possible. When you tell people that you will not chase them, guess what they do? Quick smash and grab robberies. The reason why we're seeing pot shops get hit, twofold. Number one, these are cash-heavy businesses. Because of the law, they can't do business with a bank, which makes them susceptible to the second reason, which are thieves who are emboldened by Democrat policies that guarantee that if they can get in and out before the cop arrives, they will get away with the crime. 9 times out of 10, I should even say that, almost 10 times out of 10, they will get away with the crime. Change the policy in Olympia, and you don't need to have any security assessment.
The interview.
Writing for The Hill, Ethan Blevins says a graduate student over at Antioch, which is right here in Seattle, ended up incurring the wrath of her college because she decided to actually speak up for herself and criticize their radical approach to training therapists. Ethan Blevins is an attorney working with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I can't imagine Antioch University, of all universities, provides crazy left-wing radical thinking. But take us through what the allegations are.
Sure, yeah. So Leslie Elliott is a graduate student. She's in the clinical therapy program with Antioch. She's concerned about some of the things that Antioch teaches in their clinical therapy course, a lot of critical race theory injected into the teaching, as you might expect, and teaching therapists to really emphasize race in the therapy relationship. She thought this was unscientific and inappropriate, so she posted a YouTube video criticizing it. She's a very mild-mannered person. She considers herself a liberal, so this was not fiery or really right-leaning at all. Nonetheless, the school immediately stripped her of all her student resources, meaning she basically isn't a student anymore, although it sounds like they've restored some of that. And then they've immediately lambasted her, called her a transphobic racist, and created a crisis team to help people work through this, this YouTube controversy.
So was there actually a YouTube controversy, or did a handful of lunatics just get upset and they're perpetually upset?
I think it's really the latter. It just seems like more and more of these schools are captured by a relative minority of their student body. And so I don't think that this necessarily reflects, a broad view of the university. The problem, of course, that a vocal minority is really pushing the administration around, and they're just kind of falling for it. And as a result, people like Wesley, their voice doesn't get heard. People are chilled from speaking out in the future, and you just get more of this very one-sided, dogmatic view on campus.
And that is terrifying, especially because, Antioch University, we're talking about teaching psychology, therapy, counseling. If we are, as a patient, getting seen by graduates that have been taught about intersectional identities more so than some of the basics, we're not really going to be served as patients.
Right. And this is the core of Leslie's concern, that really in a relationship like that, that's a very personal, vulnerable relationship. And yet her complaint is the school's teaching therapists to use this as sort of a prop for the social justice agenda, that their patients are really just pawns in this broader push for social change, which, of course, is not at all about serving the client. That's more about a radical political view.
Have there been any voices willing to stand with Leslie?
So Leslie has heard from a lot of people, and actually if you go on her, look at her YouTube video, you can see a lot of the commentary, and a lot of people reached out to her directly saying that they've had similar experiences. And so a lot of them simply left their programs. Unfortunately, this is a common theme, I think, for professors and students who sort of get thrown under the bus. People aren't often willing to come out in support publicly. So there's a lot of expressions of private support. But understandably, not everybody is quite as courageous as Leslie or willing to step out because they know it happens. And that's the very problem, that we have this echo chamber that universities are living in. Of course, that's the exact opposite of what we want a university to be.
What is it that she's looking for?
So at this point, Leslie's hoping at least she can get her tuition back. As I said, it's unclear whether Antioch's even going to let her pursue her program. Part of the problem is that they are requiring her and require other graduates to sign a civility pledge, which is really a euphemism for something like a loyalty oath. Mm-hmm. She's supposed to sign a document that talks about her privilege and her trans and her intersectional identities and so forth. So it's obviously very politically partisan, and she refuses to sign it. So that has created this conflict that still hasn't been resolved yet. So her position is, at least give me back my money if you're going to make me sign this. And the university, as far as I know, still has not responded to her on that.
And did Leslie not know about the reputation of Antioch before signing up?
I think that she did. I mean, well,
to at a least point, I'm assuming
on a large level.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as I said, she considers herself liberal, and I think this is happening more and more. They don't know, people don't know quite what they're signing on to always. when it comes to this sort of radical ideology that they all of a sudden find themselves stuck in. And I think that's basically what happened with Leslie. You know, you don't know exactly what you're signing up for until you get into the program.
Well, and the legal arguments here are slightly different than if it were at the University of Washington. This is a private college. They have to uphold any contractual agreements that they made with a student, which, by the way, could also include anything on their website, making claims about how students would be treated in circumstances like this. But how much of that changes the way that the Pacific Legal Foundation looks at a case like this?
Right. So we typically ourselves would only be suing a public body because we would want to bring something like a First Amendment claim, which, of course, the private university is not subject to. There are other options for. If you look, for example, at the recent Hamline University controversy, that was a private school that terminated a teacher for showing a painting that offended a student, and that teacher sued for defamation and breach of contract, and the university has really been impacted by that. So I think something, you know, there are private causes of action like that. I think she's certainly, I mean, she's been openly defamed by the university. Yep. So there are some options. I think she's still looking for a possible legal help. I don't know where that stands, but I do think there are ways to hold these private universities accountable as well.
Well, we wish Leslie the best of luck to the extent that you guys get involved. We wish you the best of luck. We've been talking with Ethan Blevins. He is an attorney working with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Their website is pacificlegal.org. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
When Rosie came to Sound Pain Solutions with osteoarthritis and an MCL tear, her knee pain didn't allow her to work or even use the stairs at home.
Besides pain, there's also psychological disturbance. And you start getting depressed. When I was looking at my life going forward,
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing her these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Fentanyl overdose deaths just absolutely through the roof. It's impacting every part of Washington State, and it's a result of the Blake decision by the Washington State Supreme Court that effectively decriminalized / legalized drugs. Democrats up until this point have not seemed particularly interested in making drug use a felony again. But my next guest has a bill that would do just that and actually did just get a hearing scheduled. Joining me on the line, Republican from Spokane Valley, State Senator Mike Patton. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, good to be with you again, Jason.
I'm a little shocked that you're getting a hearing in so much that you actually want to make this a felony again. And it seemed like Democrats definitely didn't want to do that. So take us through your law, what it actually does, and maybe some of the politics behind your bill versus the three others that are being considered.
Well, one of the bills, Senator Dingra's bill, is a basically decriminalization bill. The other two leave it as a gross misdemeanor where the cities and counties would now have to deal with all this. And, of course, the judicial infrastructure is set for it being in Superior Court, where we have drug courts that can do treatment courts, very successful for people that have felony drug possession. So we need it to be a felony because you got to have the leverage to get those that have a possibility of treatment to get treatment. There's some people that don't want treatment or never going to want it. And those you've got to deal with. And we, as you say, have an absolute crisis in our state. I know about the morgue, you know, not having enough room for all the bodies in King County, but also there is rampant fentanyl use, say, in Spokane. And, you know, businesses are moving out of downtown office buildings because of the crime. It's just gotten completely out of control.
There seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there seems to be a general agreement from Democrats and Republicans that the preference would be treatment, not jail time. Is that your general sense?
Yeah, that's the general sense. And I was a judge for 12 years. I think treatment can work for people, but most often it's going to work for the first offender or mm-hmm. something. By the time you get repeat offenders, it's more and more difficult for the treatment to work. But it can, but it's more difficult. And in any event, you need a felony as leverage to get them into yeah. treatment.
And you're not precluding anyone from getting treatment under this bill. This isn't a bill that says no treatment, straight to jail. This is a felony.
Right. Absolutely. But remember, it was a felony before the yep. Blake decision. And the court, despite, I think, making a bad decision, didn't say anything about constitutionality of a felony. It's just that those folks that wanted decriminalization all along seized this as an opportunity, and you can see what the results have been.
Well, given the fact that we all know, we all know that Democrats, for the most part, in Olympia right now, they do want to see decriminalization. So why do you think that your particular bill, of the ones that are being discussed, will actually get anywhere?
Well, we're going to have an executive session here on Thursday. I'm going to propose some amendments which combine all three of the major bills other than the decriminalization bill. And part of that will be that it become a felony after, the second, on the third offense, it becomes a felony. It's sort of like we do with the DUI laws. Mm-hmm. But I think it's got to become a felony at some point. Whether the Democrats will accept that, probably problematic, but we're going to make a push for it.
Do you get the sense of irony in that Democrats right now also want to bring down the blood alcohol level or limit for DUI, and yet at the same time they're saying that we don't want to treat drug crimes as felonies? There just is such a conflict here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely a double standard.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, I don't know. Alcohol, they can go after alcohol, big bad alcohol, and not that there aren't problems. I've been, very active, got another bill on DUI myself. But the real problem right now, even on impaired driving, is the alcohol-drug combination. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that are going up dramatically, where the alcohol alone impaired driving is stable or going down. But I don't know what goes through their mind. I mean, obviously, there was kind of a marijuana culture that existed. I don't know if that impacts it. I just would be speculating.
We're talking with State Senator Mike Patton, Republican from Spokane Valley. Republicans don't have control. They don't have the power. But when it comes to, four potential bills on the general same subject, does this give the Republican Party a little bit more leverage here?
Well, it certainly gets our message out, and we'll see how things go. But we've got that, and then we've got the pursuit bill, mm-hmm. Which is the other big major bill, which right now Senator Dingra is bottling up in committee. The question will be, will the Democrat leadership want to deal with that? And that is causing a lot of problems. And we've had cases where, somebody being pursued by police calls the police mm-hmm. and says, those guys can't be pursuing me.
I've done many of those stories, including one from Spokane Valley.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's, it's nuts.
What are the Democrats saying behind the scenes and just conversations with Republicans? I know, you guys don't necessarily agree politically, but I know you don't all hate each other. You're having conversations. What are they saying?
I think there's some division within the Democratic ranks. Obviously, they're not in the position we are, but there's some that do want to do something. I mean, there was a tremendous outcry. Mm-hmm. You had the video that was made up in Snohomish County with some Democrat mayors and law enforcement. They all came together and said these are serious problems. And, I mean, the crime rate, and you've covered it, Jason, and what's happened to Seattle and people moving out, King County losing population for the first time. All these things are happening because of their policies.
Why do you think there aren't any Democrats who are speaking up publicly when they're on the side of the people on this. This is not controversial. The folks do want officers to have the ability to use their own discretion to chase after dangerous people. There's a story out of Thurston County where, you know, deputies weren't allowed to chase someone who was suspected of, I believe it was child molestation or a sex offense against a child. It's like the average person wants cops to be able to go after those people.
Absolutely. I think there's, you know, a powerful far left base in the Democratic Party that doesn't want to see any enhancement of any penalties or doesn't want to see any change in the laws they passed back in 21. And of course, they say, well, you know, pursuits don't have as many consequences with people getting hurt as before. Well, of course, that's because there hardly are any. But law enforcement in of itself was already being very strict on their policies of when they pursue and when they don't. And most of the time, they don't. But when they do, it's a pretty serious matter.
Is it fair to say you think that there's a better likelihood that something be done on drug possession, since you do have a July 1st sunset, versus the vehicular pursuit ban? Because my sense is, just based on how some of them are talking, they're going to want to study it, and they'll pass something to, we'll do a study, even though we already have all the data we need.
Well, I hope we can bring pressure on them to do something on the pursuit. But yes, I think they'll definitely do something on the Blake because of the prior law expiring in July. So, but how meaningful it is, I don't know. If we don't have a felony in there someplace, I'm afraid it's not going to get the job done.
What's the one issue that you're also paying attention to that maybe isn't getting a whole lot of attention because of the focus on drug legalization or decriminalization and the vehicular pursuit ban?
Yeah. Well, we just had a pretty good hearing today on a bill I have on habitual property offenders, and these are the serial property offenders who would give the prosecutor the discretion to file a special allegation to seek a enhanced sentence. The judge would have to approve it, but there's and they'd have to have three within 6 months. But there are people that, you know, they're in and out of jail, and they'll do 7, 8, 10, 20 or more property crimes within a very short time period.
Have the Democrats been hospitable to hearing some of the bills from Republicans that have some substance?
Well, they've done some more. I'll give Senator Dinger credit on scheduling these for a hearing. We'll see what happens and what amendments might come up. But I do give her credit for scheduling some of these.
Well, there's certainly a deadline that you guys are up against when it comes to drug legalization or the potential, because if you guys do nothing, drugs become legalized here in Washington State starting July 1st. So good luck on your bill. I like your bill out of all of them. So hopefully it'll pass, although due to my politics, that makes me believe it's probably not going to pass. So sorry to put out that bad juju. We've been talking with Senator Mike Patton, Republican from Spokane Valley. Thank you so much, as always, for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Jason. Bye.
Absolutely.
Now,
you're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So a biologically female athlete who would get trounced if she played a male in her athlete who's not even at the top of their game, she's come out to support transgender athletes in women's sports. And I know that for some, this is one of those feel-good moments that they can signal their virtue to the world, earn some social currency amongst the progressives, but this would be the end of women's sports. And most people understand that. There is not this push from the general public, nor from the general athletic community, to allow for transgender women who are biological males to compete against them, because they know that it is inherently unfair. And when you look at, in the past, the competitions that have allowed for this, there has clearly been an unfair advantage given to the transgender athlete. That doesn't mean that they're bad people. It doesn't mean I don't understand why they want to compete. I certainly do. But the fact of the matter is they've made a choice, and choosing to identify as a gender that you are not born as, that is a choice. That is a choice. I understand, and I don't think it's easy on anybody who does that. But when we're talking about biology, we understand that there is a difference very clearly between men and women, and men have an athletic advantage. That does not make men better than women. It makes them more athletic, and inherently that gives them an advantage. Does it always mean that a transgender woman is going to win? No, it doesn't. Just because you're a transgender woman doesn't mean you would have been a good athlete as a biological male, but it does give you an advantage. In this case, writing in the Springfield News Leader, an editorial by Becky Sauerbrunn. She is a member of the U.S. women's soccer team. Missouri just put in a bill, or proposed a bill, I should say, their lawmakers, called the Save Women's Sports Act. It basically bans transgender athletes from playing in female sports. Now, Sauerbrunn has decided to push back against it. She's a defender, so maybe she doesn't think she would be at a disadvantage. She very clearly would be. But she wrote in the piece, "I'm Becky Sauerbrunn, Olympic gold medalist and two-time FIFA World Cup champion." What a braggart. "Since I started playing soccer, I faced countless challenges to gender equity in sport, from pay disparity to unsafe working conditions." Pay disparity is because you're not worth as much as the male team. Sorry. "I can assure you that playing with or against transgender women and girls is not a threat to women's sports." So she's lying. It's not even a good opinion, and she's not even giving bad analysis. This is a lie. All you have to do is look at the U.S. women's national team game several years ago against the boys' team from FC Dallas, which is an MLS club. This is the boys' team that features some of their homegrown players that they hope to develop into MLS stars for the team. They got trounced by young boys. They did. And it is why right now they're not playing men. Why doesn't Sauerbrunn and the others play males? Why don't we just get rid of any sort of gendered sports leagues, have men play women? Do it. See what happens. Tell me what happens. Now, the reason why they're not going to do that is because they know that they would get trounced against a team filled with men. But they're okay, in this case, to allow transgender folks to play because they're only talking about a handful. It's not like you'd be playing an entire team who are transgender, which would very clearly wipe the floor with the biological females. They're doing this because they want, number one, to pretend that there's no such thing as biology, that a transgender woman is the same as a biological woman. That is not the case. That's not controversial to state. It's not mean-spirited to state. It is a truth. It is a fact. So number one, they want to make this bold statement that biology doesn't exist. Number two, like I said, they don't feel as much threatened when we're talking about a team sport, because they don't have to go up against an all-transgender team. But if there was an all-transgender team, my guess is you wouldn't get the same level of activism coming from the athletes on the left. She continues, "For many transgender kids and young adults, sports offer a similar opportunity to improve their lives. It's well documented that sports help children and young adults develop critical life skills like communication, teamwork, and leadership. It also provides them with a community of peers with whom they can build lifelong friendships." Yeah, I don't disagree with that. That part's true. You could, of course, then have a transgender league. If you wanted to do that, start a transgender league. I'm told that there's more transgender people now than ever in the history of the world because it's better for them to come out. It has nothing to do with pressure and people taking political positions because it's cool and hip. Okay, well then start your own league. The same way men started their own leagues and women started their own leagues. It's really that simple. She writes, "The NCAA already has a transgender athlete policy in place to ensure all athletes can participate safely and fairly." It's not fair. "In the most elite level of athletic competition, the International Olympic Committee has a policy for transgender athlete participation. The bills up for discussion in the Senate this week seek to solve a problem that simply doesn't exist." Okay, if the problem doesn't exist, then what are you complaining about? If the problem doesn't exist, you clearly think a problem exists. Oh, no, I'm sorry. My bad. She doesn't think that because we see this as a problem, that it counts as a problem. Yeah, sorry. My bad. I forgot about the progressive arrogance that only their position matters. Only their position is legitimate. Instead, they're sidelining youth from an outlet that brings them joy, connection, and purpose. The bills don't consider any of the actual challenges to women and girls in sport. The proposed Saved Women's Sports Act does nothing to protect or support girls and women in sports. Except it does. I know you just don't agree with that, but it does. If those putting forth this legislation actually listened to the needs and concerns of women in sports, they would outline clear steps to protect women and girls from the rampant sexual assault and harassment plaguing sports. Issues we've been fighting in the NWSL, that's the Women's Soccer League. Are you saying that there is rampant sexism and sexual harassment happening in high schools and middle schools and colleges? If so, could you highlight them and tell us so we can investigate? Because there are very clearly laws against that. And I'm willing to bet whether it's Missouri or Pennsylvania or Texas or Washington, folks will actually look into that. She continues, they would clarify what's being done to ensure all institutions in Missouri are Title IX compliant. They would outline a plan to promote equal pay for women athletes. You do get equal pay. What you mean is you want the same pay as men who bring in more funds, more finances, more revenue for networks, for schools than women do. And that's not the fault of the players. It's not even the fault of the leagues. You can argue it's the fault of the public because they're the ones making decisions not to watch certain sports and to watch others. They would ensure young women and girls have equitable resources in sport, especially young women and girls of color. Why especially girls of color? I thought this was about equity. Don't you want it across the board or only for young girls of color? Instead, they're pushing kids away from the life-changing power of sports, forever depriving them of invaluable lessons sport teaches and the best friends they would find on their teams. They could play intramural. Intramural, is that the name? Sports, like club sports? You don't have to compete at the same level, and you would learn similar skills. In fact, maybe that is a compromise that they can get behind. Because then everyone is going into it knowing that there might be an unfair advantage, but at the end of the day, they're not competing for scholarships or for attention from, you know, college recruiters or professional recruiters. Is that a possible compromise, or is there no compromise? Because with the left, you're not allowed to compromise. It's a cult. You're supposed to push forward because this is all about human rights. Trans rights are human rights. Yeah. Whatever that even means. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text. Tonight, I will be on Fox News at Night, special time, 10 p.m. after the State of the Union address. I hope you'll be able to stay up that late. It is late for me. And watch it. If not, I'll post the video online at facebook.com/Jason Rants Show. One more hour coming up right after this.